This is Alan Chartok. Today we're going to have a conversation with a remarkable man, Steven Zarlenga, head of the American Monetary Institute, AMI, which is a foundation dedicated to the study of monetary history, monetary theory, and monetary reform. The AMI is a publicly supported charity founded in 1996, and Steven Zarlenga is the director. He's had 35 years' experience in the world of financial securities, insurance, mutual funds, real estate, and futures trading. He's published 20 books on money, banking, politics, and philosophy. He holds a degree in psychology from the University of Chicago and has done postgraduate work at NYU, where he was in the final graduating class under the revered Hutchins curriculum, which focused on critical reading and thought. This training, combined with his work, experience, and years of research, enabled him to reformulate what he calls the lost science of money. The author began focused research on the money problem in 1991, eventually drawing on over 800 monetary source books and materials to formulate this thesis. In 1996, he helped establish the American Monetary Institute to further the research. In 1999, Konzett Verlag of Zurich, Switzerland, translated and published the work in German. This expanded English version, released in 2002, establishes the author as a leading voice in the field of monetary history, theory, and reform. Now, let me just say, I've been talking before we have had this conversation with Stephen, and he's been places like the House of Lords, you name it. A lot of people are interested. The book itself is unbelievably big. So if you want a big book called The Lost Science of Money by Steven Zarlenga, The Mythology of Money, The Story of Power, this is the place to go. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Alan, thank you so much for inviting me, and it's great to meet you.
Well, there's a lot that we have to talk about. But basically, how did money get started? There's a very famous 2,000-year-old man bit where, Mel Brooks says, don't throw this rock at me, I'll throw this rock at you. I mean, how did money get started?
Money got started essentially out of society. Because to answer that question, you have to look not just at the archaeology and that kind of information, which is available but difficult to get. And we really don't have an exact idea of the very beginnings of money yet. But essentially, if you understand what money is, and very few people do, then you start to understand how it got started. This we call the science of money, what money is, what the concept of money is. The name of the book, The Lost Science, indicates that this science has existed and is now gone, has been rediscovered over time and then lost over time. We trace it back essentially to Aristotle. Aristotle gave us the culmination of Greek thought and experience with money. And that was that money, to quote Aristotle, money exists not by nature, but by law. And it's in our power to change it and make it useless. Now, that is saying a great deal. That's saying, first of all, money is not a commodity like gold or silver that exists in nature. Money is a creation of our society. So to have money, you're going to have to get to the point where society has been developed and where there is a respect for some type of law or custom, a means of enforcing those customs. We put the modern beginning of money at about 700 BC, and it came out of the areas of what is now Turkey on the western coast, the Mediterranean coast there. Now, this science of money, over time, it was developed. We find that not only Aristotle, but Plato, uncharacteristically, completely agreed with Aristotle regarding money, and he understood the fiat nature of money.
What do you mean fiat?
Fiat means it's a creation of the law. It's quite arbitrary. It's a legal definition, a legal fiat that makes something money or not. This science of money we find that Aristotle put forward, we find it actually employed in classical systems in Greece and in Rome. For example, Aristotle says money is not a commodity. The Spartans, when they instituted the Lycurgus's reform using iron money, Lycurgus came in about the 8th century BC and instituted a new money system made out of iron. He banned the use of gold and silver, which had been dominant there. From that point on, only these iron slugs were used as money. And the key is that while these slugs were being molded, they were purposely dipped in vinegar to destroy the metallic value of the iron. That was a demonstration, a real demonstration in practice, that it didn't matter what money is made out of, that it's a fiat of the law that is determining what the money is and what essentially what it's worth. We find examples in Rome, where Plato tells us that real metallic money should only be used in foreign trade. Rome had a whole series of coins that were only for use with foreign countries and were not usable within Rome itself. Aristotle tells us money can be made useless. We find in the Punic Wars, Rome has demonetized the money held in cities that were wavering in their allegiance with Hannibal's attacks. So we see actual examples
of
these ideas.
When you say demonetized, I'm sorry.
Demonetized means it means that since the money had been created through legal means, and the way Rome did it was to use copper coins or copper slugs again, where their value was determined by the law. There was piece, for example, called the ace grave, which weighed 12 ounces of copper, but by law was worth 30 ounces of copper. Mm-hmm. It's like a $100 bill today. $100 bill, the paper in that bill is not worth $100. It's a matter of the stamp. It's a matter of the law. When Rome demonetized it, they simply said, by law, again, okay, the money held by you guys, it's no longer money. Forget it. You
just
got the copper.
Just like we did with the Confederates.
What happened with the Confederate? But yeah, except that the Confederate happened sort of because they lost the war.
Right.
You know, and they had no choice.
Right.
Okay. And they didn't do it right. We did it right in the North. In fact, it's interesting you bring that up because the greenbacks, which came out of the Northern monetary experience of the Civil War, greenbacks are arguably the best money system that we have ever had in this country to date.
Why is that?
For several reasons. To answer that question, I need to go back to one more point regarding your...
Please, please.
Okay. Yeah. You said, how did money get started? Okay, money got started when society advanced enough to make something into money. Now, almost at the same time, we see a battle emerging in societies. I call it it's a grand social battle that has gone. I can trace it at least to Aristotle's time. Aristotle's name for money was nomisma, N-O-M-I-S-M-A, and the name for law or binding custom in Greece was nomos. So even the name of the money was based on law. The interesting thing is you don't find this word nomisma in ancient Greek texts. It's just not there. You find it in Herodotus in the 400s BC. You have to go another 100 years before you find the term nomisma in Aristotle. So we think that the concept of money was suppressed in Greece by what you could call an old boy network, the ancient oligarchy there, that preferred to trade on the basis of their relations, their debits and their credits with each other. And they suppressed this idea of nomisma, which was introduced by the more democratic Greek polis and was controlled by the polis. So there we see a battle. And this battle has continued to today. And the nature of the battle is fascinating. It's over whether the money in a society is going to be controlled by private groups within that society, and then you can figure out they're going to control it for the benefit of themselves, or whether it's going to be controlled by the public institutions of that society, the government, mm-hmm. which then at least gives you a chance that that money will be controlled for the benefit for the common good. That battle has gone throughout history.
But, of course, the oligarchs who you put on one side of this as opposed to the polis, so on the other side, the oligarchs would always argue, and argue to this day, that what they're doing is for the benefit of all mankind,
sure,
right?
Sure, and they knew better. They knew better than
they knew better
than
then, and they know better now.
Exactly. So they say. So they think. On the other hand, Alan, we do have a 3,000-year historical record that we can look at that might get in the way of that idea that they knew better. Because when we actually take a real look, and by I mean a real one, we look at the facts of money systems, what we find is that publicly controlled money has done a far better job than privately controlled money, although there has been a major effort to smear the monetary activities of government. And we trace that even back to the father of economics himself, Adam Smith. And I'll quote the line for you later in the talk.
Well, I want to hear about Adam Smith. I want to hear about greenbacks. I want to remind everybody we're talking to the author of The Lost Science of Money, Stephen Zarlenga. This immense book does justice to the way in which our money has evolved. Obviously, Stephen, just to recapitulate, in the old days, you'd have one guy just saying, here's a cow, give me that bull. And that was money. Cows were money.
At one point, yes.
But then we got this symbolic thing that represented value, that the government told us was valuable, and this we call money. You were telling me a story about why the greenback during the Civil War on the American side, you said you had to go back to the early days to explain to us why this was the best currency we've ever seen.
Sure. It's part of that struggle. The greenbacks were a governmentally controlled money system. Our government controlled the greenbacks. When the Civil War erupted, essentially the banks closed very, very quickly within about 2 weeks. There was no market for gold for several weeks. And it was left, as in all emergencies, all monetary emergencies especially, was left to the government to come to the rescue of the situation. And they did with the greenbacks. Now, the greenbacks issued by government were not a promise to pay something else. That piece of paper, that greenback itself, was the money. It was not borrowed from any bank, which meant it did not add to any national interest, did not create a debt, did not create interest payments, and the government had the power to decide where it was going to be put into circulation.
Well, then what was it?
It was just paper. It's money. You see, it's interesting you ask that question, because the concept of money is in the process of being removed from the English language. When I mentioned this at the House of Lords, by the way, you know how the Brits, they're very good with language, especially English. There was a noticeable effect around the room that several of these people understood that process, not in that particular for money, but they understood that process of removing a concept. At times, it's money from the language. And the concept of money, when you say, what was it? It was money, plain and simple. Now, some of the supporters of the greenbacks understood this problem of the concept of calling it credit and misnamed credit. One of the best of them, a guy by the name of Benjamin Franklin Butler, Civil War general, put forward the idea that what you call this greenback is a certificate of value. Now, my position is just call it money. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, some of our listeners are confused, Stephen, right now about this.
Uh-oh,
we don't know what you mean when you say it's just money. I mean, if it doesn't represent silver, or if it doesn't represent gold, or if it isn't a promise to pay you back, then what the heck is it?
It's a legal power. It's an abstract legal power, as Aristotle outlined and as Plato agreed. It's a power of government, a power of society, which is abstract, and it doesn't. The Spartans showed that it didn't have to be made out of something valuable. They took something that wasn't that valuable to start with, iron, and destroyed the iron value, because the commodity value actually got in the way. It interfered with the thing as money. You have to understand, if you make gold into money, you are handing the monetary power over to the private groups who control the gold. You're handing it to the people who have the gold. This is what Alexander Hamilton did at the beginning of our country. You're handing that power to private people who can control that commodity. You're handing the power to the governments in which those commodities are to be found. And one time that the argument was, well, you're just going to help South Africa and Russia because they had so much gold. And the key thing, you're removing the monetary power from society when you do that. Now, our view, Alan, is that there is going to be a monetary power within society, whether you admit it or not, whether it's admitted or not. We think it's as important as the legislative, important as the executive, just as important as the judicial branches. And therefore, our solution of how money should finally be structured involves it becoming eventually a fourth branch of government.
So you think, for example, to educate us, that Alan Greenspan and the Fed might be the fourth branch of government right now?
In a sense, they are. But out of control of the people. Out of control. They're a power unto themselves. I mean, when Alan Greenspan's going to give a talk on money, everybody listens, you know. And they're all anxious to hear what he's going to say. And what the Fed does obviously affects all of our lives. So it affects us more on a daily basis than judicial decisions do. It affects us more than the executive, usually, on a daily basis. So it's a massive power. It has to be recognized as such and brought within. What we would do is not destroy the Federal Reserve, but nationalize it and put it within the U.S. Treasury with the idea that it evolve eventually into a fourth branch of government.
Yeah.
By the way, they loved that idea at the Treasury.
But they did.
They really did.
Talk to me about Adam Smith. Who was he? What did he do?
Adam Smith is known as the father of economics, and he was a kind of a philosopher. He was an instructor and a professor. We look at Adam Smith in a somewhat negative way because of what he did to money. Now, there's a lot of things in his one book on economics.
Now, when you say we, you mean your institute does,
yeah, I mean,
and you.
Yeah, sure.
And
okay.
You mean you. You
I
don't
say,
mean all
I
of
should
us.
Say I.
Yeah, okay.
You got me. What Adam Smith did with money was to misdefine it. And actually, Adam Smith created the subtitle of the book here, The Mythology of Money, The Story of Power. While Aristotle and Plato and others, Bishop Berkeley before Adam Smith, a brilliant, brilliant writer.
What years was Adam Smith with us?
Well, he came out with his book 1776, same as...
Declaration of Independence. Yeah. Easy enough to remember.
Right, that's how you remember. Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley, who the great university on the West Coast is named after, he wrote a book on money about 40 years before that. Really an excellent book where he got the same principles as Aristotle put forward. Ben Franklin wrote a book about that time. He wrote brilliantly on money. Franklin was a great writer on money. So was, Locke, John Locke. Mm-hmm. Adam Smith comes along about 30 years later. He had their books in his library. And Adam Smith introduced a mythology of money into economics at that time from which it has not recovered. And economics will not recover until they can first come up with a good basic definition of money. They don't have one. I mean, that sounds incredible to you. I know.
Well, so far I haven't heard a good explanation from you either. In other words, what you said, Stephen, is money is defined as money. So I need a definition of what money is.
I'm gonna read one to you. What I've called it in general, I've said that it's an abstract power.
Okay, we get it.
An abstract power. Here's what we have for the definition of money. From Aristotle, money exists not by nature but by law. From Plato, a money token for purposes of exchange. From Julius Paulus, the Roman jurisconsult, this device being officially promulgated, circulated and maintained its purchasing power, not so much from its substance as from its quantity. Then a long darkness. From Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley, whether the true idea of money as such be not altogether that of a ticket or counter. From Locke and Franklin, who viewed money as a pledge for wealth rather than wealth itself. And from Alexander Del Mar, the greatest monetary historian of all time, we have really the best definition. And here's what it is. What's commonly understood as money has always consisted, tangibly, of a number of pieces of some material marked by public authority and named or understood in the laws or customs, that its palpable characteristic was its mark of authority, its essential characteristic, the possession of value, defined by law. And its function, the legal purpose to pay debts and taxes, the mechanical power to facilitate the exchange of other objects possessing value. Now, I'm going to add two things. Oh, also from Knapp, the great theorist. Our test, the money is accepted in payment made to the state offices. Mm-hmm. And what we add, what the American Monetary Institutes add, we accept these concepts and add, money's essence, apart from whatever is used to signify it, is an abstract social power embodied in law as an unconditional means of payment.
Okay.
There's our formal definition. I'll tell you what Adam Smith said with money.
Yes, I want to go back to Adam Smith.
Okay. Adam Smith came on the scene, introduced a mythology of money counter to Aristotle's science of money. Adam Smith said, money's nothing more than gold and silver without any regard to the mark on the coin. Now, to understand how far backward that is, he regressed the concept of money backward from At his time, there was a system of gold coinage where the value was by the stamp. He regressed the concept of money back to where it was in England before the Romans had arrived. That's where it was then. Now, the Bank of England had already moved forward 80 years before Adam Smith into abstract money, but privately controlled, misapplied. And they did that in practice, not in theory. Adam Smith came along, not in practice, but in theory. Adam Smith regressed the concept, destroyed the concept of money, all the legal aspect of money, in theory, but in practice, he was a strong supporter of the Bank of England and their abstract money. So if you try to apply Adam Smith's theory to Bank of England practice, what you're going to get is mystery. And that's what we've gotten. And that's why one of the reasons we have such great mystery. Bank of England substituted its abstract credits in place of government money. That led to about 125 years of warfare, continuous warfare.
Why?
First of all, the king who allowed it to happen was an import from Holland, William III of Orange. And William III wanted to support every war that Holland was involved with. As credits of the Bank of England were loaned to the government debt dramatically increased. Payments to the Bank of England from the government for interest dramatically increased. And so it was good for the bank. It was very good for the bank, very bad for England. It led to horrors. It led to an institution of taxation. The taxation led to things like the Irish potato famine, where the landlords, in order to pay the taxes on the land so that the government could pay the Bank of England, had to put the pressure on their peasants. The misuse of the money power, using it privately, as shown in the Bank of England, can be a very dangerous and very bad thing.
You mentioned Alexander Hamilton, a guy I've been reading a lot about lately.
Yeah.
What was his contribution to money?
Alexander Hamilton was really an interesting figure. It was just at the New York Historical Society's exhibition of him, which is quite interesting. I'd encourage people to go look at it. But he's being lionized there, essentially. And you find Alexander Hamilton being lionized in the financial press here. Every few years, there's going to be something, and this is the latest. What Alexander Hamilton did was not what was really necessary. He established the first private central bank in America.
With George Washington's support, I may add.
George Washington said, okay, do it that way. Hamilton and Jefferson were asked.
But Jefferson didn't like this.
Jefferson didn't like this. Now, Washington, here's how it first, I've got to give you again the lead up into this bank, because then you'll really understand it.
Sure.
Okay. Hamilton's first Treasury Secretary there. The very first thing he did, and to understand Hamilton, you've got to read what one of my neighbors wrote about him. My neighbor, Martin Van Buren, the eighth president of the United States, wrote the most fantastic book.
Do you know him in the family?
Well, he's buried down the block about 2 miles.
Go ahead.
I've been there. The name of the book, by the way, The Origin of Political Parties in the United States, really outstanding. I think the best book ever written on American politics. And what he describes Hamilton, because he was sitting down with Jefferson, he went to visit Jefferson, Van Buren did, before Jefferson died, and got the inside information from him. Here's what Hamilton did. Very first act of government was to take the outstanding war debts of the colonies, not even states at that time, but colonies.
Quite right.
These were defunct. They were worth less. They were zero. They were nothing. Pennies on the dollar. Okay. Who was holding them? They're being held by the soldiers, the sailors, and the guys, the merchants who supplied the revolution. They were being held by the good guys that gave us a country, basically. Congress sat in secret, closed session under Hamilton's drive and determined that they would back this debt dollar for dollar. They were going to pay off all this debt. While they're doing that secretly, agents for speculators going throughout the United States buying up these certificates held by the good guys for pennies on the dollar. Now, Madison argued. Madison came forward and he said, look, this is not fair. We see what's happening. We'll pay the original holders a dollar on the dollar. We'll pay the speculators something less that we'll determine. You can do that with the law. He was voted down. Okay, so all these bonds were then worth full value. That was the first step in setting up the central bank of the United States, because here's what happened next. The Federalists introduced legislation to charter a national central bank, private one, on the Bank of England model, to be privately owned.
Now, when you say private, what do you mean?
It was a share bank. It was a corporation which had shares which were owned by private individuals.
Much like a modern corporation.
Yeah, exactly. Except this one would be given the monetary privilege by the government in Congress. Now, there was only one bank in existence at that time, the Bank of North America. Had we had a lot of banks, we probably wouldn't have had a revolution. The Bank of North America was a Pennsylvania state bank. Hamilton said to this bank, look, if you guys want to be considered as our national bank, come forward, make changes, and we'll think about it. They did nothing. Inexplicably, this was a tremendous advance in power and profit. They sat back, did nothing. Hamilton's people, Federalists, put through legislation for the first Bank of the United States, Bank of England model, privately owned. On the day of the public offering of the shares, the bank's shares are oversubscribed within 2 hours. Of the $10 million that's supposed to be paid into this bank in gold or silver, only one-tenth of it is ever put in gold. Nine-tenths comes in the form of bonds. Mm-hmm. Which bonds? Remember the bonds that Hamilton turned from pennies into dollars that were really being paid by the American people through taxes? Those bonds became the basis of the first bank of the United States, privately owned, privately controlled, but paid for through taxes and through this process. All right, that's bad enough. There's one kicker to this situation, and that is we find out why the Bank of North America didn't come forward. Bank of North America had been 60% owned by the U.S. government. It was a good bank. It was formed on Tom Paine's initiative, actually. The new bank was only to be 20% owned by the government. President of the Bank of North America, Willing resigns the presidency of the Bank of North America and is put in as president of the First Bank of the United States. So there they go. They reduced the public participation from 60% to 20%. That's how private central banking began in America.
And the implications, had we done it a different way, the result would have been very different. And you would have thought it would have been a better deal.
There was a choice. Our whole experience up till that point had been with government-controlled money. You see, neither Holland nor England allowed money into the colonies. And the colonists were always under monetary stress. They had to try every kind of monetary experiment. We were a great monetary laboratory. We tried everything here, from land banks to commodity, agricultural commodities as money. We did all these things. Finally, the radical solution came out of Massachusetts in 1690, where they issued what they called bills of credit, just paper money. And it was not a promise to pay anything. It was a promise to receive these paper slips back for taxes and fines and dues. And they found that they hadn't intended it as money. It immediately began to circulate as money. Hmm. So that's a demonstration that really all that it takes to make something money is to accept it for taxes. So we had this experience. And from Massachusetts, then other colonies immediately started. Franklin got one started in Philadelphia, where instead of spending the money into circulation the way Massachusetts did, the Pennsylvania colony lent the money into circulation, and they earned the interest on it and used that interest to defray colonial expenses. So that shows you what might have been done with a government central bank instead of a private one. The interest on the money creation, this is called, seniorage, it's called, could have gone to the whole country to be used for the common good instead of going to private individuals. Even more important than that earning of interest was the power to determine where the new money created would go.
But of course, there's another, believe me, I'm not nearly caught up with you yet. Just to remind everybody that we are talking to Stephen Zarlinga, The Lost Science of Money, The Mythology of Money, The Story of Power. Okay, Stephen, let's go back to Alexander Hamilton. Now, he had something else going for him there, because Hamilton not only was interested, of course, in monetary policy, and many people think that he was absolutely brilliant. I know that many people hated him, and Burr killed him.
Another neighbor.
Nevertheless, he also had something else that had to be accomplished, which was basically the nationalizing of these colonies. In other words, these colonies had to be brought together, and the formation of this bank was one of the things that helped to do that in this country, although I take it you would argue, would you not, that he could have had his bank, but he could have had it under different terms.
Absolutely. And this, we can see this even in the, and I would say better terms. In the actual Constitutional Convention, it's fascinating. It came basically out of the Federalists wanting a stronger national government.
Right.
And it was commercial interests that really got this thing scheduled as a convention. And you've got to remember, some key people were not there. Jefferson was in France. Tom Paine was not there. Right. He was in France, I think in jail, possibly at the time. Ben Franklin was so old that he couldn't deliver his final speech at the convention. Somebody else had to give it for him. So when we say the Constitutional Convention, it's different from the guys writing the Declaration of Independence. Sure. It's a bit different. They're calling this convention to strengthen the national government. But the money subject, and it met from May till September, money subject does not come up until mid-August. This key factor in government power doesn't even come up. And a book had appeared, a Calvinist minister, the only religious signer of the Declaration of Independence, John Witherspoon. It was a book on money. And he wrote it anonymously at the time, but later it was determined he wrote the book.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going around.
Oh, sure.
Publius,
everything was anonymous,
Federalist Papers.
For some reason. Yeah, right. I understand that. Anyway, the book essentially supported Adam Smith's concept of money as just this crude, metallic, material concept of money rather than the advanced, abstract concept of money. That money is just gold and silver. And the delegates at the convention didn't know enough about the monetary subject, frankly. We had an excellent experience with money in the colonies, and this was stonewalled by Witherspoon. Witherspoon points out all the good arguments for money. For example, the complaints about the continental currency. Well, in fact, the U.S. authorized $200 million in dollars in continental currency, issued exactly $200 million in continental currency, during which time the Brits counterfeited untold billions. We have no idea how many they counterfeited, but they had ships in New York Harbor counterfeiting. Wagon trains were caught carrying counterfeit money around the country. I asked our British friends if they ever find out how much they counterfeited to let us know for the record.
And the purpose of this was to undermine the revolution?
To wreck the currency, the
sure.
continental currency, which was working fine and did carry us over 5.5 out of, they carried us within 6 months of final victory of that revolution.
Okay, so back to Hamilton.
Okay, so the delegates of the convention are sitting there, influenced by Witherspoon, by Adam Smith, whose book had come out a bit earlier, and they argued over this point, and the point was in one phrase, to emit bills of credit. And even there, they were misnaming it, okay, in my view. I should have just said to emit money. But they argued over this. That was the magic five words that contained the money power. Mm. And they didn't put it in. It was already in the Articles of Confederation. It was Article 9 of those articles. So here they are. They're brought together ostensibly to strengthen the national government, and they won't put in this key feature of national power, which was already in the Articles of Confederation. And the reason some of the delegates didn't want to put it in was they intended to have their own Bank of England, their own, they wanted to have this power themselves, as had been done in England from 1694. So we did not get a clear picture. At the same time, it wasn't quite left out. What you find, Alan, when you do monetary research, that in the Anglo-American world anyway, there's always an ambiguity. It's always left ambiguous. Just what is the Federal Reserve really governmental controlled? I say no. But libertarians will come and tell you, yes, it's part of the government. There's always this ambiguity that is left in the money picture. But the power is never ambiguous. The power is always there, and it's privately operated, and that's the key. So Hamilton is asked by Washington. The bill is put forward to create this a charter for a national bank, a private national bank. Washington asks Jefferson to comment on it. He asks Hamilton to comment on it. Now, when you read these comments, first thing, Hamilton's reaction to this is about 37, 40 pages of typeset answer. I don't know how he could have gotten it put together so quickly, but he did. And Jefferson's just a fairly short thing. Jefferson was very weak in what he wrote because Hamilton had the argument. The argument was that the money power was essential. You had to have a money power in a society, and that was his basic argument. And even though it wasn't clearly in the Constitution, he argued, he brought in and introduced, actually, and this is a good thing about, I think this would be a good thing I'd admire Hamilton for, he introduced the concept of derivation of powers. What's the term for that? The,
yeah.
You know
right.
what I mean? Yeah. Where it implied powers. He used that, mm-hmm. and he was right about that. And he was right that we needed a money power. And Jefferson was wrong in those 5 week pages that he wrote. He just wasn't
yes,
up to par.
But let me just get this straight for our listeners. There are really two things going on here. There's what you would call the public-private fight over who
yeah.
should control the money,
yeah.
you know, or, but there was also the states versus the national model going
yes.
on. So you had
yes.
these two
right.
things. Now, most historians pay much more attention to the idea that Hamilton, in creating the bank, was strengthening the federal government as opposed to the states, and that that's why, if I'm getting this right anyway, Jefferson hated the Hamiltonian model because Jefferson thought that this was back to the kind of monarchy that we had seen from the king. He didn't want
yeah.
that. But you're saying there was a subtext that
subtext,
was going to,
yeah.
on here.
And here's what the subtext is, and this is our thesis of the book.
Yeah.
The subtext is the concept of money. What is money? Hamilton's argument for a private, and the key, Hamilton's argument for the private central bank was that this is the only way that you're going to get these gentlemen with the money, i.e. with the gold and silver, to come forward and do it. This is the only way they'll do it. That's mm-hmm. part of his argument. They won't do it on any other terms.
That'd be an incentive.
Yeah. And what that is relying on, therefore, is Adam Smith's misdefinition of money.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this is the key. Had money been properly considered as a legal power, then you can bet that the Constitution is going to have provisions in it for it to be made available in a proper way, in a just way that doesn't favor one group over another group, that everyone would understand. That would be in the Constitution. It's not there. It's not there because of the misdefinition of money introduced by Adam Smith, or at least formalized, crystallized by Adam Smith.
Well, I don't want to go too far afield here, but my reading in this area indicates that Hamilton was a bit of a self-serving character. Later on, the one major policy error, apparently, according to Joseph Ellis, that Washington made is that Hamilton was the first guy who really wanted this standing national army, and frankly, he wanted to be the head of it.
Oh, really?
Right. yeah.
Well,
and he wanted to be the head of it. And John Adams, bless him, was the first person who recognized, you know, the problem and who
yeah.
detested Hamilton, even
yes,
though they were on the same,
yes,
sort of,
yeah,
same
yeah.
sort of side on this thing.
Right.
Now we have a national bank. They have their way. Of course, Jefferson gets elected president. Real unhappy about the way,
oh, yeah.
you know, things
oh,
are
yeah.
going. And, right. But Jefferson doesn't do well as president, and as a yeah. result, he dies and says, don't put my presidency on the tombstone.
Oh.
You know? Okay. So now, but we only have, and I'm really sorry we're running out of time,
oh.
19 minutes left here.
Oh.
So I want to make sure that we all understand the modern evolution of what has happened.
Oh.
Because right now we have this monetary policy that you've alluded to. Alan Greenspan really is in charge of the fourth branch, although not announced, of government. He has to be appointed, but once he's appointed, he has tremendous power
yeah.
in terms of inflation, in terms of how much we...
Interest
this,
rates.
This symbolic thing called money
yes.
means.
There, you got
you
it.
Know,
you got it.
Right. So he comes out and he says, well, we're going to lower the interest rates and therefore it's going to be harder to use money or easier to use money depending on what they do. Now we're in a world economy. You have spoken to the G8, right?
Actually, I spoke to the TOES, the other economic summit, which is held contra to the G8.
Which is more of a liberal sort of...
it's a progressive, I would call it, progressive. It's a populist.
Well, except that, now, you've always posited this. You say, on the one hand, you have private control of money, and on the other hand, you have the police controlling money. Right from the very beginning, you've been describing
from the beginning,
this.
We see the fight.
Yeah, you've been talking about that. And you say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, correct me if I'm wrong, that when the polis controls things, and for example, you would use FDR and buying our way out of the Depression, basically construction of all of the bridges and everything else. But you would also say, in our earlier conversation, you said to me, you would also say that George Bush using the same money, billions of dollars, would be a misuse of money. Would you not?
I wouldn't say because it's George Bush doing it, but I would say I would put it in these terms: the money power can be used, or it can be abused. When it's privately controlled, it tends to be abused because there's simply no way to ask the controllers to do things that are against their own interest. They're going to generally see the world, and they think they're doing the right thing because they think they're wiser than everybody else, as you pointed out. But if we get back to Jefferson's idea that you can trust the people, you would tend to have better results under government control. And the key is this. When you talk about government control of money, what's brought up is, oh, that's inflationary. And there's a mythology created that the government has done a bad job in controlling money. When you actually look at the facts, it's just the opposite. Government's done a decent job of controlling money, sometimes an excellent job, and the privates under control have done miserably, basically. And these are historical facts. It's not a question of interpretation, really. We don't have time to go into, if you interview me again, I'll go into some of these details with you, different cases of we got the greenbacks, we got the continental currency, we got even the German hyperinflation that's always brought up as a reason why the government can't control money was done by a privately controlled, privately owned German central bank. And the hyperinflation began the very month that the Allies insisted that all government control over it be removed.
So okay, but wait, Stephen, because all of us have to have time to catch up with you. If you were czar right now, king.
Oh, thank you.
And could go zap, how would you change the American monetary system so that money meant something else?
Okay. We have three provisions that we come down to, three parts of reform. First, the nationalization of the Federal Reserve System. You don't want to destroy it because it has 90 years of institutional knowledge. That's very important.
Now, when you say nationalization, what do you mean?
It becomes fully owned, fully controlled by the U.S. government. It's placed into the U.S. Treasury as a department there to be run from there and to develop.
As opposed to now, which is?
Now it's essentially privately owned, privately controlled, ambiguously influenced.
So when you
by
have
government.
The Board of Governors, for example, that come together to set inflation policy, who are these guys?
They tend to be friendly to banker interests, or they become part of that.
But they
once
are
they get in. They're very
paid and appointed by government, right?
I think paid by the Federal Reserve itself. They
okay.
may be appointed. They may be appointed in most cases by government, or at least confirmed. You have to understand something, Alan.
The Fed
is a moving target.
Yeah.
It keeps changing. And if you're going to follow the Fed every minute, you're going to have to be reading a book that thick every 2 or 3 months to keep up with all of the regulation changes. Now, how would I change things? Here's what I would do. That first thing, nationalization. Second part would be the banks no longer have the power to create money as they do at present through a fractional reserve banking system. At present, the banks can create more money than has been deposited into them by depositors. And I don't want to get into exactly how that works because of the time limitation.
We'll take your word for it.
Okay. I would remove that power because it's a vast privilege in private hands that the rest of us don't have. You and I can't really create money the way a bank can. The third thing I would do is to specifically move forward on infrastructure. We're very short of money in this economy right now. Ted Koppel had this great show on airlines not able to charge enough money and to cover just their costs. But he didn't come to the last conclusion of that was the American people don't have enough money right now. That's the fact. Okay. We are short about $2 trillion in infrastructure, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. Infrastructure repair and just keeping it up to a good level. That's $2 trillion.
Well, of course they're going to say that because that's where their bread is buttered. But go ahead.
Well, okay. let's say that there's $2 trillion that's a backlog that has to be done. I'd start reasonably creating the money to do that. Now, what's that going to do? It's going to create jobs all around the country. These are jobs that only Americans can do. It's going to be putting money in relatively small amounts into depressed areas like Schenectady.
Well, it's true, but there's relatively low unemployment in this country now, right? So why does that problem have to be fixed?
I would argue that the unemployment is higher than they're saying because they're not tracking people.
Well, that's true. We know that.
And I'd argue that 4% or more is not low. Mm-hmm. I'd argue you need to get down to 1% to have low unemployment. But people who want to work, you understand, people are offering themselves in a form of slavery, and they're being turned down. This is terrible. This is not good. Now, here's the key thing to remember about the creation of money to get to your question. I'm finally getting to I will answer. Why is it good to create money for some things and not for others? The kind of things that a government can create money for in infrastructure, and I include education in infrastructure, definitely. These are things, when government creates money, it can go for infrastructure and good things that are of concern to all the people. When it's privately created, it tends to go in far more into speculation, to make a quick buck, anything to get the numbers bigger, without regard to where the money is actually going. What good is it doing? If money goes into infrastructure, it's not inflationary because it's creating things of value in the society that can that increase the efficiency of the people through better roads, through having divider lines printed brightly on a highway at night. You don't get killed with oncoming traffic. That's a nice feature.
But Stephen, didn't the Soviets have publicly controlled money, and didn't they fail?
They did, and they failed. And I'm not saying that this is going to be the single one solution that'll get you into paradise. It's part of the problem. I think the Soviets had other problems, including that faced off against a very great power, and they were basically
that was always
on a war.
Their excuse.
They're
was
on a any, war. Okay,
anything
war
that didn't
footing.
Work was capitalist encirclement.
They felt they had to have nuclear weapons. all these horrible things that happened. If we had another hour, we could start on that. But let me finish now with this problem. And you mentioned earlier when we were talking that Dr. Krugman said that we're heading into an accelerating inflation. And I think he's right. And the problem is that the money that's being created now is being blown up in bombs. It's being blown up in missiles and being shot down in airplanes.
Building bridges or...
Yeah, there's a big difference what you use the money for. Mm-hmm. If you use the money to destroy, and the
but
fact
there are a lot
is,
of people, if I can just interrupt you for one more unconscionable minute. There are a lot of people who will tell you, Stephen, won't they, that the Second World War is what got us out of the Depression.
Yes.
Because we spent our way out and there were a lot of bombs. Now, it may have been a better cause, but it was just as non-productive.
You have hit on a key point of the relation between the private money power and the government. Roosevelt was trying everything he could to expand the money supply. Money supply dropped by, I think, a third from 1929 to 1933. Roosevelt was trying to do everything he could to expand the money supply and get prices back up. And that meant prices of wages, prices of everything which had collapsed. They wouldn't let him do it. He was stopped at every point. And what the economists were saying, by the way, here they are in the middle of the century's worst deflation. And the economists were saying, oh, that would be inflationary. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a mantra that's all.
Same thing we hear now.
So finally, Roosevelt was able to put about $15 billion back into the economy through all of these alphabet organization creations. And close to $100 billion had been lost. He wasn't able to do it. As soon as it was for warfare, the bankers, the economists, no more opposition. Oh, go ahead. And they immediately, we have this in chapter 20, they immediately began of the Lost Science of Money book. They didn't care about spending money for war. That was okay. That was allowed. And I think probably the most serious charge that I have against the bankers is that they wouldn't allow government money creation for the things that would help the people, the things that would give you new plant, new equipment, right, new jobs, good things.
But they would allow...
Yeah, they would allow it for destruction, killing, blasting, not just Americans, but foreigners as well. And to me, that's the most serious charge that I make against them. And it brings into question, you know, what the hell are you guys doing? Come on now. We've got problems in this society that are easily solvable. We don't have to concentrate on social issues that are insoluble and that are really polarizing our country. Why don't we first do some of these things that's good for 99.99% of the people? And the reason we don't do it, we don't understand the nature of money. We don't understand that we can do it.
Hmm.
We're not allowed to.
And yet, blue collar polis, as you would put it, they're the guys who voted George W. Bush, who embodies this philosophy which you reject, into office. Is that just what Marx would have called false consciousness?
What consciousness?
False consciousness.
I don't know that much about Marx, except that he made the same monetary mistake that Adam Smith did. He came out and he said the same thing, money is gold and silver, basically with a few extra little embellishments. I wouldn't put this entirely on George Bush. First of all, George Bush is smarter than we think, as we found out from his first news conference on being reelected. He was talking at a normal speed and in normal words, the way his brother in Florida speaks.
Yeah, you know? Fascinating.
Yeah, very fascinating.
I agree with you.
So I wouldn't put this on a particular president. It's not individuals that are responsible here.
But you could argue, could you not, that there are two forces, as I think you did very articulately a minute ago. Mm. Those people who would put the money that we create into production for 98.9% of the people, and those people who would say, no, let's put it into production for ourselves, the so-called oligarchs, which you spoke of earlier. And George Bush certainly is, if nothing else, representative of that second group.
He did say they were his base in one speech. I saw.
It was the Al Smith dinner. It was funny. But you know, as Freud said, there is no joke, or was supposed to have said, and I think his joke really told the truth.
Yeah. Now, I would say that I don't think Bush is operating on this level regarding the money, that he is thinking, I will do it for that, but I won't do it for that. I don't think it comes up to him. I think it comes up to him in choices and who's putting forward these ideas.
Well, should you do, not what you say. I mean, certainly that's what he's doing. But let's take a few minutes to talk about the rest of the players in the world and their money supply.
Oh, yes.
So now you have Japan and you have China. There's a balance of trade in their favor. They're taking our paper there, if I understand this correctly. How does that act on our money supply?
Unfortunately, a large part of our cash money supply has been allowed by Alan Greenspan. I'll rather put it on him than on George Bush. It's been allowed to get out of the country. Our dollar bills, our $100 bills, are in some countries the main currency. It's not circulating here. So we don't have the use of that. That I consider something that Chairman Greenspan should have controlled better, should not have allowed to happen. Regarding the Chinese balance of trade difficulty, they should be, in theory, we buy from them, they should buy from us. They're not buying from us. They're taking our money, our Federal Reserve notes or Federal Reserve credits, and they're earning interest on them. They put that as a reserve for their money, and they're actually able to earn interest. Now, we should not be paying interest to other central banks. That should be a feature. That would encourage them, rather than holding on to those notes or whatever, that would encourage them to come back here and spend that money here. And that would encourage American corporate movers and shakers to keep some factories operating here, you know, to accept that money back and pay Americans with.
So then how is our philosophy of free trade working out?
I don't think it works very well. I don't think it works very well. The initial idea of of England not sending or not allowing money to be sent to the colonies was a form of globalization. They wanted the materials back from us. They didn't want American colonies trading among themselves. So globalization, it says one thing, it does another. It's having a very bad effect, not just on Americans, but on the people that we're trading with. and it's getting a free ride intellectually.
In the old days, you were on the street. And one thing I always heard from my stockbroker friends is, country's just printing money. They're just printing money, and there's nothing behind it. They just keep on printing money. You and I couldn't do that. Well, does it turn out they were right?
Not only turns out they were right, but by the nature of money, that's a good way to do it. There's nothing wrong with printing money. Money is a fiat. You see, you get the Austrian school in America, right. Austrian School of Economics, which I consider monetarily illiterate, frankly. And these guys, they've made their reputation by what I call incestuous self-congratulation. One of them congratulates another. This has been observed for over 100 years. Henry George noted this, that he could find nothing of value in what they write in their interminable volumes of self-congratulations from 100 years ago. Now, they came over here after World War I as the monetary power shifted from the Bank of England to America. And that happened because of the fact that the gold was flowing into America and their system, they wanted a base on gold. They came here wearing a freedom mantra on their cufflinks, these Austrian guys. But in reality, their policies promote what you could call plutocracy, which is rule by the super wealthy. Now, through Ayn Rand, who I'm sure you're familiar with, she put them on the map in America, actually. They caught her mind on the question of money. She was hoodwinked by them, basically. And she put them on the map, and thereby they got into libertarian thinking, because libertarians formed around Ayn Rand's followers against her wishes. She told them, I don't want you guys. Get away from me. You know, you're just here to steal my ideas. But the Libertarian Party has carried this forward, and so they don't get votes, but they're out there, and whenever one party does something that's very far to the oligarchic part of the equation, libertarians are there to say, it's not enough, providing a kind of backbone to wrong thinking.
Well, I know that you've been somewhat protective of George W. Bush. You don't want to
go too far. No, but we are a 501c3, and we're not supposed to get into politics. And you have to understand that there some guy from the NAACP recently got into trouble over this. We're careful about that.
Well, I understand. But on the other hand, this is a sort of a forum, an intellectual forum. And
when I go to Washington next week, I'll talk to Republicans and Democrats, because it's a bipartisan thing. It's not 98.9% of the people that would benefit. It's 99.9% of the people. And therefore, the Republicans should be as interested in this as the Democrats.
My point about George Bush that I'd just like to make for a moment is that when, in fact, he has faith— tremendous faith in the idea that if you leave a free market, if you allow the wealthy to take this money, it'll all trickle down. You'll take care of other people.
Yeah.
We saw it with Reagan, didn't work with him, and I don't know that it's going to work Bush. But it is a matter of faith. These guys truly believe this works.
Yes, they do. And when you say faith, this is very interesting. What we mention in the book from the Overleaf is that a whole generation of Americans has been misled. An entire generation has been led astray into market worship and other forms of religious fundamentalism. And so I agree with you, this faith is misplaced especially when we have such a rich history to look at to get a better grasp of how these things really work, how these policies do or don't work. And it's there in our own history, and that's why this book is so thick, because rather than do theory, I didn't like the idea of using theory so much, I wanted to present case studies.
Let's talk about this and thank our guest, Stephen Zarlenga, at the same time. The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zarlenga, The Mythology of Money, The Story of Power, and You Get Your Money's Worth. This is a big book. And again, Stephen, thank you for taking all this time. I know that I've learned a good deal today, and I do appreciate your being here.
Alan, this has been a pleasure, and I want to thank you for not just for having me here, but for all the wonderful radio you give us.